But now our book at bedtime is The Body on the Beach by Simon Brett. Jude has gone along the coast to Brighton to interview Tanya, the former barmaid at Feathering Yacht Club. She's also had to relay some alarming news to Carol back at home in Feathering. Nick Kent, the troubled schoolboy, has gone missing.
You have called the police, have you? Carol asked. Maggie Kent's voice on the telephone was tight with the effort of controlling her emotion. Yes. At first, they weren't all that interested. Then I told them Nick had been with Aaron Spaulding the night before Aaron died, and they began to take me a bit more seriously. I rang your friend Jude because I thought Nick might have confided something to her last week. And had he? Oh, a few bits and pieces. But he was in such a dreadful state all weekend. I'm scared he'll do what Aaron did. Carol had her own ideas of where she'd start looking for the boy. And, with a bit of luck, she'd have Ted Crisp there to help her. She took a large rubber-covered torch out of the cupboard under the stairs and put on her Burberry. Tanya lived in a tiny bedsit, which, because it boasted its own bathroom, the landlord had the nerve to call a studio flat. She closed the door behind her guest and demanded, "What's all this, then?" She looked massive, stolid, and resentful. "As I said on the phone," began Jude, "I'm talking about a body that was washed up last Tuesday morning. The body of a middle-aged man. We know you saw it." The girl sniffed. "All right. About this body. Yeah. I was going for a walk on the beach and I saw it. And I didn't tell no one, because if you've ever been in care, you know that anything where the police is involved is just going to cause you a lot of grief and hassle." "And did you see anyone else on the beach that morning?"
"No."
"Oh, yeah. There was some old girl taking her dog for a walk."
"I see," said Jude.
"Going back to the body, had you seen the man before, either dead or alive?"
"Bloody hell, no. As far as I'm concerned, he's just some poor bugger who fell off a boat or something."
"Why?
Do you know who he was?"
Carol looked at her watch and saw, to her irritation, that it was already 7:10. There was no sign of Ted Crisp at the entrance to the yacht club where they'd agreed to meet. She sensed she had to act urgently. She lifted the latch on the gate into the forecourt. The sea was a long way down the beach, its rustling muted. Carol trembled a little as she approached the boat. Then she heard the noise, a low keening, like that of some small injured animal, and it came from inside Brigadoon 2. Carol held her torch at the ready. At the moment she flipped back the boat's cover, she pressed the on button. Blearily frozen in its beam was Nick Kent's face. Tears coursed down his cheeks, and he lay curled in a fetal position against the fiberglass hull.
"Nick," said Carol gently.
The boy squinted into the light.
"Who are you?"
he sobbed. "My name's Carol. I'm a friend of Jude. Your mother's been terribly worried. She really wants to see you, Nick."
"No, I can't see her, not after what I've done."
"All I know is you need to go home," said Carol. She stretched out her hand over the transom of the boat. Slowly, the boy rose and put his icy hand in hers. As he stepped onto the back of the boat, she braced herself to take the strain. Suddenly, he shook his hand free and landed facing away from her. He hit the ground running and weaved his way through the rows of boats towards the Feather.
"Help!"
shouted Carol up towards the club room. She dropped her torch and ran as fast as she could, but Nick Kent was faster. By the time she reached the railings, he was already standing on the sea wall. She heard behind her a clatter of feet and men shouting as she called out,
"It's all right, Nick. Everything's all right."
But the hue and cry she feared had started. One of the yacht club members had found a powerful spotlight, which he focused on the trembling boy. That was the final straw. The boy recoiled, then turned away, and trailing a thin scream, disappeared over the sea wall into the feather. Carol reached the sea wall ahead of the others. The feather was at low tide, and Nick had landed in the mud, the impetus of his jump planting him up to his thighs in the ooze. The level of the water was rising fast. There was a gleaming new ladder against the sea wall. Though encumbered by her raincoat, Carol took a foothold on the top rung and swung herself down. The ladder stopped about a yard above the mud. She undid the belt of her Burberry, slid it out of the loops, and tried to flip it across the void. The buckle landed right by Nick's hand, but he didn't even try to take hold of it. The metal ladder boomed and shook as someone came down to join her.
"We can get this rope to him," said an elderly male voice.
She squinted upwards. "You'll have to lasso it round him. He's not cooperating."
"Damn it," said the voice. I'll get some duckboards."
The tide was now sending ever stronger waves against the outflow of the feather, and with each hissing onrush, the water level crept closer to the stranded boy. Carol slipped out of her precious Burberry and flipped it out towards him.
"Nick," she called, "grab hold of my coat." "Oh, for God's sake, Nick, is this really how you want to die?"
"I don't care how it happens, so long as I die," came the petulant reply.
"But, Nick, what would your father think?"
"Don't talk about my father," he shrieked. "He'll never come back. He's gone for good."
At that moment, a rogue wave broke noisily behind him, and he suddenly grabbed hold of the hem of her Burberry. The shock of his weight almost wrenched Carol's arm from its socket.
"Okay, we're coming with the duckboards," a self-important voice announced from the top of the sea wall. "Easy does it. Oh, bugger."
"For Christ's sake," bawled Carol, "throw down our life belt, you stupid old fools."
Then she was aware of the sound of a boat's motor putt-putting closer. Craning round, she saw a small wooden launch approaching, with two men in it. The boy's head was now only intermittently visible between the waves. Then, near the boat, there was a splash and a man swimming. Just as the swimmer approached the spot where Nick had been, Carol felt a jolt, and the counter-tension in the Burberry had gone. Then the swimmer shouted,
"All right, he's breathing through the snorkel. Chuck the rope down."
There was the sound of a winch, and the swimmer eased Nick's body out of its clammy prison. They manhandled the inert mass over the stern of the boat, and then the swimmer pulled himself aboard. There was a cheer from the top of the sea wall. Carol realized she had no strength left in her arms. Then she felt a ringing through the tubes of the ladder as a heavy body descended. When she felt his strong arms safely cradling her, she said tartly,
"You were supposed to meet me at 7, Ted Crisp."
"Oh, really? I thought you said 8.
Then someone's torch beam lit up the little launch. The bedraggled figure of Nick Kent looked very unsteady, but at least he was upright. He gave Carol a wave and a sheepish little grin. To either side of him were Dennis Woodville and, soaked to the skin but triumphant, Bill Chilcott. "My friend Carol and I have been working it out, you see," Jude explained. "There's the body you found, Tanya. There's Aaron Spaulding, who committed suicide. And then there's the dentist, Rory Turnbull, who we're meant to think has committed suicide. You know Rory Turnbull, don't you?"
"Sure," said Tanya. "He was treasurer down at the yacht club."
"And he sometimes gave you a lift from Brighton to Feathering for your evening shifts."
"How do you know that?"
Jude shrugged. "When did you last see him?" The girl coloured.
I finished working at the yacht club Friday before last. Round then, I suppose.
And you haven't seen him since?
No. Anyway, he's gone missing, hasn't he? Petulantly, the girl kicked at the carpet with one black-booted foot. What's all this about? Is there something you definitely know about this body I saw on the beach?
There are two things I definitely know, said Jude. One is that there is a connection between the body and Rory Turnbull. The other is that Rory Turnbull is still alive.
Well, said a voice, you're right in at least one of those.
The bathroom door had opened silently, and there was a third person in the room. It was Rory Turnbull.
Maggie Kent ushered Carol into the bleak front room. Would you like coffee or something? I'd offer you a real drink, but I'm afraid I don't have anything.
Don't worry. You just go and sort Nick out.
Yes. He's gone up to start the bath. I'll give him a good scrubbing.
One thing, said Carol, it's not my business, but if I were you, I wouldn't ask him what happened. He'll tell you when he wants to.
The mother nodded.
I'd already decided that.
But would you mind staying till I've put him to bed? I'd like to hear your account of what happened.
That's fine, Carol looked at her watch. But may I use your telephone?
It was the moment after Rory Turnbull had appeared from the bathroom, before Jude had had time to recover from her surprise and say anything, that her mobile rang. She snatched it from her pocket. Hello?
Jude, it's Carol. Nick Kent's all right.
Thank God. Listen, I found... But the mobile was ripped from her hand and switched off.
I don't think you need tell anyone what you found, Rory Turnbull said coolly.
Carol, who'd never had a mobile phone, assumed they were unreliable machines and prone to constant breakdowns, so she wasn't surprised to have been cut off. Jude had definitely heard her say that Nick was all right. That was the important news. Anything else could keep.
3/4 of an hour elapsed before Maggie Kent came back downstairs.
He's tucked up in bed and I've given him one of my sleeping pills. But he did want to have a word with you, just to say thank you.
Carol found Nick propped up on pillows under a duvet with a Manchester United cover. He looked exhausted, but calm.
I just wanted to say thank you very much, he slurred. Should have thanked the men, too. Didn't thank them properly.
Don't worry. There'll be plenty of time to do that.
There was a shelf of treasures by the boy's bedhead, and on it, Carol saw something which unleashed a landslide of explanations. Among Sabutio footballers and swimming certificates stood a framed photograph. It showed a smiling, grey-haired man in his late 40s. Undoubtedly, the missing Sam Kent. And also undoubtedly, in spite of the fact that in the photograph he had no tooth missing, the man whose body Carol Seddon had found on Feathering Beach.
And Joanna Tope reads the final episode of The Body on the Beach by Simon Brett tomorrow evening at 11:15. The producer in Edinburgh is David Jackson Young.